You're listening to the Mind Over Murder podcast.
My name is Bill Thomas. I'm a writer, consulting producer, and now podcaster. I am now trying to use my experience as the brother of a murder victim to help other victims of violent crime. I'm working on a book on the unsolved Colonial Parkway murders, and I'm the co-administrator of the Colonial Parkway Murders Facebook group together with Kristen Dilley.
My name is Kristen Dilley. I'm a writer, a researcher, a teacher, and a victims advocate, as well as the social media manager and co-administrator for the Colonial Parkway Murders Facebook page with my partner in crime, Bill Thomas.
Welcome to Mind Over Murder. I'm Kristen Dilley.
And I'm Bill Thomas. Only one of us is wearing a hat today, and that would be Kristen.
And he's been making fun of my hat, please notice, for the last 15 minutes.
Although I actually like the hat so much that I thought I would go and get my hat too.
Well, it's been an interesting week or week and a half. Time really has seemed to run together here since everything happened with the pandemic. So I'm honestly not sure how long it's been, but it has certainly been an interesting week or week and a half here in the United States.
I think it's been 3 months since the pandemic and about, I think we're closing in on about 2 weeks since the Black Lives Matter discussion and the George Floyd, I think we have to call it a murder. There's been a lot going on, as my mom would say.
It's been an interesting process trying to find my voice related to all of this. As a writer and as an educator, it's important to speak. As a white woman living in the South who has had a fair amount of white privilege, it's hard to know when my voice is appropriate and when it's important to step back and let other people speak. So Bill and I have been trying to figure out over the last couple of hours, how are we going to approach this discussion?
It's definitely a struggle, and I feel somewhat the same way. I'm a white guy originally from the Boston area, which is a place that people may think of as a liberal bastion, but has plenty of racial tension and prejudice. We had a ton of problems when I was a young person. We moved back there when I was heading into high school, and that was back during the busing era. I hear what you're saying about being a white woman from the South, but as a white man from the Northeast who's lived all over the country, I feel like kind of prejudice and animosity that we're seeing spill out once again on the streets of America's cities and towns. This has been part of our legacy for over 200 years. Speaking just for me, I think it's very important to say that Black Lives Matter unequivocally and without question. I'll be attending a small rally this afternoon in support of Black Lives Matter. All of us need to find a way to understand that America's law enforcement agencies have got to shift gears and right away. When we're killing 1,000 people a year, that's 20 people a week. They're not all as blatant necessarily as George Floyd, but they are systematic and they are a very serious problem. We are a country that is awash in guns and violence and the potential for violence. And yet I'm very struck by the white privilege that has been on display over the last few weeks. How is it that a group of heavily armed, almost exclusively white protesters can get in the face of law enforcement in Michigan, at the State House, and in other places around the country with no incident whatsoever, screaming inches away from the faces of state troopers and other law enforcement? For the most part, not even a single arrest. When a racially diverse group of protesters very righteously hit the streets to protest police violence, suddenly there's all kinds of problems. Now, we're not condoning in any way, shape, or form vandalism, window breaking, or looting. As a matter of fact, I think those things are happening because there's a very, very small percentage of people who are willing to take advantage of the fact that law enforcement have their hands full handling tens of thousands of peaceful protesters who are merely hitting the streets to express their outrage using their First Amendment rights of free speech. Once again, we see white privilege on blatant display. It's okay for you to get in the face of a state trooper if you're white and heavily armed, but if you're African American, Latino, Asian, or young, and you're merely marching on the streets of your city or town to express your concerns, that's a problem. And when I see Minneapolis police officers on the internet today pepper spraying peaceable folks just standing alongside the road, and these very clearly marked Minneapolis Police Department SUVs come along and spray protesters who are doing nothing wrong and nothing illegal, I might add. This I have to say to the Minneapolis Police Department, you folks are doing yourselves no favors. The police in Buffalo knocking down a 75-year-old man and sending him to the hospital with a concussion. And by the way, doing absolutely nothing as he lies there bleeding from his ear, clearly in distress. Cops in New York City throwing a woman, and I don't care whether this woman was behaving in a way that was annoying. Cops are trained to deal with annoying people. Throwing this woman to the curb and leaving her there, barely able to move, not only does the cop throw her to the curb, there's clearly a supervisor, a lieutenant, you know, the folks that wear a white shirt, is directly behind this cop. They just march on past and leave her there, lying by the curb, injured. This is law enforcement doing itself no favors. Now, I know we're a true crime podcast. We have a lot of friends in law enforcement and former law enforcement folks. There is no way around this. Law enforcement committing acts of police brutality at rallies designed to highlight Americans' concerns about police brutality are doing themselves no favors.
And we've been lucky here, and by here, I mean my localized area. There have been several excellently organized, peaceful, thoughtful protests that have happened in Williamsburg over the last couple of days. They've been well orchestrated, and there have been no issues, but that's just in Williamsburg. There have been protests in Richmond. In my opinion, it is well past time for the Robert E. Lee statue to come down. And I am very glad that there has been an agreement from Governor Northam to remove the statue. It's one of only several on Monument Avenue that need to come down, but I'm very glad that the Lee statue in particular has been the central focus of the protests up there in Richmond. It has been an interesting and enlightening and certainly confusing and frustrating and scary time over the last 2 weeks for, I think, just about everybody around the country trying to figure out, how do we respond to this? What is my responsibility? How can I make my voice heard? And there are no easy answers to this. As an educator, I've been trying to figure out, especially now that we're here at the end of the school year, I don't have any opportunities in my own classroom and haven't since March 13th, to speak to my students. And there's really only so much that I can convey via Teams or Zoom or anything else. Trying to figure out going forward as an educator, how can I be responsive to the populations that I teach, and how can I diversify my curriculum? That's something that I want to pay particular attention to over this summer as I get ready to go back to school. You know, I feel like it's important just as an educator to try to figure out, how do I fold these recent events into my curriculum so that I can be a responsive and respectful educator to the best of my ability.
In other true crime news, I know many of you have been following the Madeleine McCann case. She is the 3-year-old girl who disappeared 13 years ago now in 2007. While her parents, who were from the UK, were visiting a resort in Portugal. It's been announced just over the last couple of days by German police that a man suspected of murdering Madeleine McCann is currently in a German jail. They are seeking additional information about a man the suspect is referred to as Christian B, the letter B, who's 43 years old. He has an extensive criminal background, including, very unfortunately, rape charges and allegations. He seems to have been involved in a drug dealing, theft, fraud, a number of different offenses, and then perhaps most pivotal to this case, rapes and sexual assaults against young girls. He was also sentenced to 7 years for raping a 72-year-old American woman in Portugal in 2005. Very, very sad case. We're not intending to cover the Madeleine McCann case. One of the things we try to do here at Mind Over Murder is cover cases that are lesser known. Respectfully, we're not going to jump into JonBenet Ramsey or Madeleine McCann or other cases that many, many other people have covered and quite well. This is a case that we've followed with some interest for a number of years. It'll be very interesting to see how this unfolds. Police now have released photographs of a Jaguar automobile that was transferred the day after Madeleine McCann went missing. This car was owned by and was apparently this guy's pride and joy, as well as photographs of a camper van that he and his girlfriend at that time were living in Portugal near the resort where the little girl disappeared. Interestingly, phone records, even releasing phone numbers, which I don't think we would necessarily see much of that in the United States, where police are seeking additional information if anyone knows more about these phone numbers, the transfer of this car, this guy's whereabouts, the camper van where he was living. They're clearly seeking additional information, and much of this springs from comments that he was overheard making in a bar in Germany, his home country, on the 10th anniversary of Madeleine McCann's disappearance while watching coverage. This would have been in 2017. So a lot of this new information that they've been developing with German, UK, and Portuguese police is as a result of these unfortunate comments that he made in the bar in 2017.
You know, and we were just discussing, we are glad that there is a break in the case, because certainly an ongoing case with no answers is difficult. Bill, of course, knows this firsthand. We were also discussing the fact that we are glad that at this point, it seems like the suspicion has largely been removed from her parents. And we are glad to see that. They have been dealing with the probable death and certainly the disappearance of their young daughter for the last 13 years. That only has to be compounded by the suspicions of, you know, not just law enforcement, but pretty much your average Joe on the internet who has gone out of their way to say, well, I'm pretty sure the parents did it. It is always good to hear when there has been a break in the case and, you know, the parents or family members can be cleared of suspicion. On a lighter note, we are continuing our discussion with CSI writer and producer David Rambo for a second episode. We are so thrilled that we've had such excellent responses to episode one. So we hope that you enjoy episode two. We will have one more episode with David Rambo before we move back into our coverage of criminal cases.
Tell us a little bit more about the writing process. We hear about people who are writer and writer producers like yourself, and they talk about the writing room. Is there actually a room, and are writers ever writing together at the same time in the same room?
Sure. The writing is in pretty much three phases. There's the initial breaking of the story, which is done by a group. And that's where we sit in the room, this conference room, and write on the whiteboard all the different beats and things. It starts as a very loose process. We'd like to do this. We'd like to see that. Here's a scene that might be fun. But once we kind of have the world of the story we're telling, we start with the true crime. What really happened? And at what point in the life cycle of this crime is there a crime scene that our people come upon? And what do they see? What are their first instincts? What do they need to do? What do they need to preserve? You know, just going through all that process. And then the second phase of the writing is when you go off with what you've just created in the room, the writer who's actually going to write that episode, or in some cases, two or three writers who are sharing credit, and they go off and you start typing, and that's done alone. You don't do that around other people. And then the third phase of it is the rewriting. And this is when the writer delivers their script, their writer's draft, and the showrunner, who was Carol Mendelson, and then eventually a co-showrunner during my time there, co-showrunner Naren Shankar, would rewrite. And on our show, the writer of the episode rewrote with the showrunner. You sat together and did the next pass. And the reason the showrunner does that last pass that becomes the shooting draft is that keeps the voice of the show consistent. But what was great about the process was that Carol and Naren were very, very accomplished writer producers. And we each got to learn from them so much in the rewriting process. Why this scene doesn't work here, why you need to move that, why the act out should be here, you know, where you break for the commercial. It was thrilling. My first episode, Butterfly, taught me so much about that process because I didn't know a thing about writing television. I'd come from the world of the theater where you sit in your pajamas until 4 o'clock in the afternoon working all by yourself and nobody sees you and you don't have to think out loud. You don't have to listen to other people's ideas about your story or try to pitch ideas on theirs. So it was very jarring for me, a very tough adjustment, frankly.
Even just not working in your pajamas.
you get to do that when you go off to write the script. So I went off to write after this long process, during which Carol saw to it that I got a crash course in television production. I was involved in post-production, pre-production, shooting of multiple episodes so I could see what all the departments were doing and get to know the people. And I was still, believe me, even the first day of shooting a Butterfly, I was still a wide-eyed kid at the circus. But I went off to write my draft from the outline that we came up with in the writer's room. And interestingly, I was writing it up at Lake Arrowhead, where I have a little retreat I go to write to. And there was a huge, huge fire coming up the mountain, and we were all evacuated out of the town. And I raced down the hill. I grabbed my laptop, raced down the hill, and I realized when I got to the bottom of the hill off the mountain that I had left all the research up in
the
cabin. I thought, how am I going to do this? Well, I came home and I wrote and I delivered a script that was unproducible, 70 pages, just that's about a third more than it should be. But it was the outline. And Carol said, okay, let's start. And she and the director of that episode, Richard Lewis, and Anthony and I sat in her office. And Richard would go off to do scouting, that come and check on us from time to time. And we did a page one rewrite. And the entire thing changed when Richard came in. He said, listen, this is a, and by the way, there were elements of Butterfly that were inspired by pretty horrific real life crimes. One in particular where a body had been dismembered and put in Ziploc bags mm-hmm. in someone's freezer. I was just really, but Kristen, you know, dismemberment was a big part of the Butterfly story.
Yeah, very, very much was, yeah.
And we knew it was a girl who was the victim, and we knew she was having an affair with this older doctor. She was a nurse. But Richard said, you know, what if the victim looked just like Sarah Seidel, the character that Grissom can't express his love to, but he's really in love with her? What if they looked like alike? It would kind of force Grissom to examine his own feelings, not just a crime. Well, he had just auditioned a girl for something else who looked so much like Georgia Fox that we couldn't use her on the show. Georgia played Sarah Seidel. But to cast that actress, and I'm so glad she was game for it because I got a career out of it. We cast this girl who looked very much like Georgia Fox, and it just opened up that episode emotionally mm-hmm. so much, culminating in a final monologue for Grissom. Another one of those, you know, Billy saying, I'm not going to say any of this, and then showing up and delivering it time and time again, word perfect. And it was a life changer for me, but that was the process I learned from the get-go, and it worked well enough that they offered me the staff job when we were done.
This is the part when I admit that I've have a longtime crush on Georgia Fox, right?
Oh, she's great. She's my neighbor now. Oh, we live just a street apart.
Yeah. Send her my best regards.
I will. She's fantastic.
I don't doubt it.
Yeah, she's great.
But that's as far as I can take it because Pamela, my partner, listens to this podcast and she's like, what's this thing about Georgia Fox? I'll be in trouble for sure.
I'll keep you out of trouble.
Yeah, okay. Either that or this part ends up on the cutting room floor.
Can I say something about the fans of the show, though? It's my
Please
first
do.
Experience with medium, the power of this medium. 2 days after it aired, I got a phone call from CBS that there were flowers waiting for me at Television City.
Wow.
Which was then the CBS headquarters in Hollywood. So I went over to pick them up, and I thought, why am I getting flowers? Did someone not have my home address? And it was from one of the fan groups.
You're kidding.
Fans of this relationship that Grissom and Sarah would or would not have. They'd been in their imaginations for 3.5 seasons, and now it was out in the open. They gave me a plant, this gorgeous plant that 16 years later is still thriving in my breakfast room.
It's funny. It's helped them realize this romantic notion they had about the two characters.
Yeah.
And the
which I mean carried all the way to the end of the series.
Oh yeah, well you know, and I'm forever grateful to Jonathan Lippman at Bruckheimer Entertainment Television and Anthony Zeiker. They asked me to come back and help Anthony craft the story for what became the series finale, a 2-part
movie.
And I was so honored. It was me and Elizabeth Devine, who was a real life CSI, became a writer producer on that show and then CSI Miami.
Mm-hmm.
And I think she may have done CSI Cyber as well. And the three of us and a writer's assistant, Jack, just hammered out crazy story, but was all for the fans. And we had so much fun just jumping into our lab coats again and coming up with crime scene and character. And that Grissom Sarah story was a big part of the series finale.
It was tremendous. I love that finale.
I'm so glad. That makes me happy.
I love really the happy. Fact that the fans sent you flowers, this beautiful plant, to thank you for helping realize this romantic notion that many people had about those two characters.
I loved it too, but the other writers were a little pissed off. One of them said, well, we never got flowers. Nobody ever got flowers.
Now David shows up and he gets flowers.
Yeah.
So were there stories that you wanted to tell on CSI that you were never able to get to?
Oh, sure. First of all, there were a lot of real life crimes that inspired some of our stories that we just never found a way to tell. There were some that we really tried time and time again to try to tell, and we just couldn't find the way in. And that happens, you know, in that episode, Butterfly, it was the first one where Grissom doesn't get the guy.
Mm-hmm.
The killer goes free. And I always had hoped that I could do a story because, you know, there was talk from time to time after William Peterson left the show that he would come back, that he comes back and this time he gets the guy that he kills again and he gets him. I never got to tell that. I would have loved that. By the way, that actor, killer, Kyle Secor, terrific actor.
And oh, yeah, he's fantastic.
Such an enigmatic character. He was one of those men you love to hate characters. So that was the big one. I can't remember specifically what crimes or arenas that we never really found a way to crack, but I remember we would talk about them from time to time, finally throw our hands up and do something else. We did like playing with the form. There were a couple of episodes where we played with time, would tell a story to some extent in reverse or zigzag back and forth in time. And there was one we told called 4x4, one of my earlier episodes, where we had four stories that happened at exactly the same time. We would just rewind the clock.
Very cool.
And depart. You know, it was like the same point of departure for each, but we would rewind at the end of one and start the next from that same point of departure.
Right.
Which I believe was a walk through the crime lab.
I would imagine the there are a lot of challenges built in there for your director and your editing team and so on to try to tell a narrative, because it's still got to make sense. You have to be able to follow the story times four.
Yeah. And that was a real challenge. Our biggest production challenge, and there were a lot of them, you know, we created some enormous sets. We had to do a scene in one season opener where Sarah Seidel was missing and she was out on the prairie and a coyote had to come and find her. We built the prairie on the soundstage.
Did you really?
Coyote, yeah, we couldn't have the coyote running around out in the wild. So we that whole thing was built. Remember, there was a truck turned over on her?
Yeah, it's the dead doll. Yeah, she was trapped under the convertible.
Yeah, We built that whole landscape.
Oh my God, that's amazing. Like, Bill's smirking at me because I'm fangirling.
Yeah, you guys are like way into this.
the scale of production show meant we could do just about anything we wanted to do.
Right.
To your point, Bill, about how all the departments have to take a script and it's a challenge. They always rose to the challenge.
Yeah, yeah. It's got to be cool, though, because people must enjoy the, how do we execute this in a way that, is consistent with the look and feel of the show, tells the story. It's got to make sense. And like you said, there's an art form here where you have to tell a story in about 43 minutes.
Yeah, that's all we had. And it had to be intricate and challenging and bring people back, viewers back after a commercial.
Mm-hmm. We passed by something I wanted to circle back to. Carol Mendelsohn was a showrunner. Were female showrunners that common at this point? Wasn't that pretty innovative at the time?
Oh, it was. It was trailblazing. There weren't too many of. There were a few and very accomplished. But no, she was one of the few.
Mm-hmm.
And she actually had a Vegas element to her background. Her father was a labor lawyer who represented Las Vegas interests, and she would spend summers by the pool at the Riviera when she was a little girl growing up. So she sort of grew up in the world. She was very well suited for this, very well suited for the show, her interest and her sense of just dramatic television. She started working with Stephen Cannell on a show called Wise Guy. And Cannell was one of the great crime and just entertainment producers of the 60s and 70s, Greatest American Hero, and I think MacGyver might have been his. I'm not sure. But she started on Wise Guy. Even though she was a writer on the show, she was always the one they asked to take notes or to type something because she was the girl. And by the time she came to CSI, she was, in every sense of the word, a showrunner and a terrific.
One of the most frequent questions we're asked here at Mind Over Murder is, how can I help?
Thanks to Othram, a leading forensic DNA testing lab for law enforcement, you can get involved and help solve real cases.
If you have tested at a consumer genetics company, you can contribute your data to DNASolves.com. The process is easy and confidential, just two simple steps. Your DNA might be the missing piece that helps solve the identity of an unknown person.
Then Mind Over Murder will highlight cases Othram is working on to seek your crowdfunding support for DNA testing to help solve these cold cases.
Upload your DNA profile to DNASolves.com. It's easy, free, and confidential.
Then join Mind Over Murder as we help families find answers with Othram and DNASolves.com.
One. I owe everything to her.
Well, and it sounds like, she brought such an amazing skill set to the job at a time when there weren't very many women running shows. These shows,
and by the way, in the early season, yeah, Bill, I should credit, in the early season, she had a co-showrunner, another woman named Ann Donahue. They did the early seasons together, and then Ann went off to pretty much run CSI Miami, and Carol stayed with Vegas.
Right.
And they were both real uncompromising storytellers. Really, really terrific.
Did certain things become easier over time? For example, when the show hit, I was curious about situations where, you bring in these major directors and you've got all these guest stars. After the show was a hit, was it easier to get guest performers and directors to come in and take on particular episodes? I suppose once you're hot, then everybody wants to work with you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was a lot easier. And we would get calls all the time from agents for actors and directors who wanted to do something on the show. And we got some great cameos, in the Tarantino. We mm-hmm. got Tony Curtis and Frank Gorshin.
Yeah, really.
Sit down and kibitz in a Vegas little corner of Vegas for a 2-minute scene. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, absolutely.
Everybody knew it. And in a way, particularly for stars who weren't making as many movies as they used to, but were still huge names, it was a way to sit down with their grandchildren and impress them. Hey, look, grandpa's and grandma's on CSI.
Well, and if you think about it from the perspective of a working actor, it's a great guest gig, to get booked in great stories, a terrific core cast. And then there's always some outrageous story that you guys are going to tell. I would imagine it was probably fun for a lot of these guest stars to come in.
I think so. And a lot of, you know, young actors or emerging actors got their Screen Actors Guild cards doing our show. For a lot of them, it was their first role. I heard from a friend the other day who did an episode called Let It Bleed, the fifth or sixth season, playing a zombie butcher.
Right.
He called to thank me for the little residual check he just got. It was probably $2 at this point, but, you know, it keeps on giving.
Well, and it's funny, too. I was thinking for the up-and-comer who's, you know, looking to break into the business, get their SAG card and so on. Of course, your choices are usually you're going to either play somebody who's been dismembered or someone who is doing the dismembering.
Yep. Oh, it requires a lot of acting, not get to just lie on the table. And often there were flashback scenes with the body and whatnot. So occasionally we would have a, you know, a favor to a friend. Yeah, you can be a body. This one just, you know, was in the background. We would do that. But even though those victim parts were really good breaks for some of the actors who got them. And of course, it's a little like the SVU thing or now the Dick Wolf Chicago shows. The goal was to do all of them.
Right.
You know, to do right. The trifecta, to do Vegas, Miami, and New York.
Yeah, yeah. And then it's funny, for a lot of working actors working in the Dick Wolf genre, they would do guest appearances and maybe in a smaller role, and then you'd have to wait a certain number of months. And then so sometimes if you watch carefully, you'd see a lot of, you know, New York theater actors show up. They'd play a prosecutor, a smaller role, and then, yeah, you know, at some point, maybe later that season or the next season, they'd show up as a judge or a cop or whatever. I know that people said those were great gigs and people would always look for those opportunities. I can imagine that happened with CSI as well.
Oh, all the time. And we did have a policy that every now and then the network would say, no, we've used them, we can't use them again or something. But if we could persuade them that they would not be recognizable.
Right, right.
And they didn't want them. It was very hard to get an actor who might be on a show that would be competing. For instance, we were up against Grey's Anatomy a lot of the time I was on the show. Mm-hmm. And if it was an actor who was particularly prominent in a role on Grey's, I don't think we would always get permission to use them. Little things like that that you'd never think of. But by and large, we had great fun actors. They always loved the work. And we did some horrible things to them. I mean, I think of this poor girl, there's a show called, was it Russian Dolls is what I'm thinking? I think that was the title. Sarah Goldfinger wrote about mail order bride from Russia who was buried in the desert. And that poor actress, like, she had to get in the hole and poured hot tar over her, which really was what they did. They poured hot tar over the corpse. But our girl, we poured chocolate syrup over her.
But nonetheless.
exactly. This horrible wind, you know, and she got up, they hosed her up. Very good natured, big smile. Hey, it's another, you know, day living the dream.
Yeah, speaking of insects showing up.
Yeah.
Let's pour hot chocolate all over somebody.
Okay, here's inside baseball on the maggots.
Ooh.
They weren't always maggots. They were often grub worms because maggots under the studio lights would mature too quickly. The lights would accelerate their maturation process. Yeah, pupa.
Oh, God.
Take after take. So you don't want them curling up and going to their next phase. You want them to keep crawling.
No, heaven forbid. Yeah, yeah.
So Grissom had a couple of tarantulas. Were those Billy's?
Oh, the tarantulas were always real. The tarantulas were real tarantulas. Billy didn't own them. But yeah, we had a tarantula wrangler.
Oh, it's funny. Those are some of my favorite credits. I love, you know, oddball creature plus wrangler in the credit.
Yeah, we had a lot of those.
So, David, what kind of training did the actors get to ensure the authenticity of their performances when it came to, say, the testing and the lab equipment and so on and so forth?
You know, they were all sponges. They were really good about it. They just absorbed it. We had a real criminalist on the set every day of shooting, even if it wasn't, if there were no process scenes, they were there. And they they were really good, to my surprise, about doing things like taking the specimen, you tweezing it into a test tube, using the pipette to put this fluid in and then that, and put it on the centrifuge and then running it through this or that or whatever. And they were really good with the technical dialogue. I was very impressed because I don't think any of them had done anything scientific like that before. In fact, you know, CSI created a whole new genre of crime television. All of that process in the lab, if it happened in a criminal story, usually happened off camera. I don't really recall seeing scenes in a crime lab unless it was something simple like comparing fingerprints. And they didn't really, I mean, we made the APHIS database visual.
Yeah.
For the first time, I think, in television, and the CODIS DNA base. Granted, our video for that, you know, which was animated. We always animated the search with the ding, ding, the match or no match.
Right.
It doesn't really look like that, but we were telling the story through those visuals, which made it really clear for the audience. But the actors loved it. They were really good with it.
Yeah, and I think you're right. I do think credit has to go to CSI because I think previously, you know, I've been an avid film and television fan and reader for many years. Before then, it was mostly referenced. They would say, well, we're going to send this out to the lab, or we got a fingerprint match, or what have you. And yet, obviously, you as writers and producers had to figure out, well, how can we make that visual? It's a visual medium. We have to tell the story in a way where it's not just two people talking at each other with endless verbiage and no visual.
Exactly. And we had three units to do that. One is the main unit that filmed all the scenes, all the dialogue, everything on our standing sets. And then we had a second unit that had a stage in Pacoima, I think, or North Hollywood, very far out along Sherman Way, which was, I think, an old warehouse or factory or something that we converted to a two-stage effects stage. So all those close-up CSI shots, you know, where the bullet would go through the tissue.
Yeah.
Or you'd, you know, just see the pipe being unscrewed right at the joint. That, all of that, the basis so often that animation was laid over. Even in the Theory of Everything, the squirrels coming to nibble on the on the wire, which we had a squirrel and we put peanut butter on the wire. And the squirrel.
was there a squirrel wrangler?
There was a squirrel wrangler, and I learned a lot about squirrel breeding that day.
maybe even more than you needed to know.
Exactly, because different squirrels and different species of squirrels have different gifts, and some were trainable and some are not. Anyway,
amazing.
That was the second unit. And then the third was the virtual unit, which was the on-screen visual effects, anything that was CGI or computer animation. So it really took all three to make an episode, which is kind of feature production television.
We were talking about something this afternoon, by the way, to that point. What happened to all that cool stuff that was the sets for CSI?
You know, I don't know. I was not there when they wound down. I can tell you at the end of the season, sometimes they sold off the wardrobe. And it just so happened that George Eads, who played Nick Stokes, and Eric Zamanda, who played, why am I blanking?
Greg,
thank you, Kristen. Thanks for reminding me. Sanders. I know them by their actor names so much now because it's been years since I wrote for them. They happen to be similar to me in some sizes, so I could usually score a nice jacket or something at the end of the season.
Very cool.
I love it.
I don't know what happens, as I was not there when the series ended. I do know that our sets were stored. Some of the sets were stored in the hopes that we could get that two-hour series finale.
Right.
And by the time we got the green light, we had lost our stages. In fact, they've been torn down at Universal Studios. They're putting up a Mario Brothers attraction, I think. Our stages and Desperate Housewives and the Ghost Whisperer stages all got torn down.
Oh, that's too bad.
Oh, it's and the Phantom of the Opera stage. That breaks my heart. That's been there since 1927. They had saved enough of our sets that on our effects stage that I was telling you where the squirrels ran, we were able to recreate enough of the lab, the PD, and autopsy to do the scenes for the series. But it was cramped. It was very cramped, but we could do it. I don't know what happened to the equipment.
I don't know. Would have been cool, you know, in the den, maybe,
a microscope or something.
A couple of microscopes, exactly.
I kept props, like one prop from each of my episodes, whether it was Sherlock Holmes' pipe or a little toy dinosaur. Yeah, I have like one. I would ask for one thing if I could keep it. So I still have. They're all scattered all over my house.
Like you said, that bloody axe really meant so much to me. I'd like that just to keep it around the house.
Nah, I didn't get any of the weapons.
No, probably not.
But you did keep the pipe from I Shot Sherlock?
Yes, I have that pipe.
That's great. That is a great episode. Yeah. So much fun.
Thank you. I think that was my third. I think that's the third one I did. That's great. Yeah.
That was very clever. Very clever.
Thank you.
Okay, so each character seems to have one type of crime that they have a hard time responding to. Like, we know that Sarah and Nick have a big problem responding to crimes involving children, like, understandably, because of their background. So were there types of crimes that you found particularly difficult to write about?
Oh, wow. The true answer, Kristen, is yes, all of them. One of the things that I always would say or try to make the room aware of, because it's easy when you do a show like this to get glib about death and the crime. And I would always try to remind people and myself that a death is an enormous event. It's an enormous event in someone's life. Even if it's someone who really has no living relatives, there is a hole somewhere in someone's heart because there's no chance of finding this person again. We always had to remember that. And the CSIs know that. And if we can get that moment in the writing where they show up at the scene and they're doing the job and there's just something that they connect with that makes them more emotionally connected to the crime, at least, even if only for a moment, it would make the story that much deeper. I know for me personally, we did a couple of episodes where kids had been bullied and it led to disaster. And I always found those really, really touching. Really tragic and hard to write. But even the guy, we did a crazy episode, I didn't write it, called Dog Eat Dog, where we had a guy who couldn't stop eating.
Now, oh, that's okay. I remember that one.
Yeah, I'll tell you why we wrote that episode. We never had an episode run on Thanksgiving, a first run. If they ran a CSI, it was always a rerun. And one year the show was doing so well and CBS said, we want a Thanksgiving CSI. And we really, for some reason, the writers did not want to do it. So then we found out about this syndrome called Prader-Willi, where you can't stop eating. You literally have no off switch for your appetite.
This sounds like a very subtle, maybe not so subtle form of protest.
We'll show America what CSI after Thanksgiving's food fest. So, there was that one where we kind of got a little vengeful on. Just in terms of
did the network ever?
It wasn't fun to write, believe me.
Did the network ever call you on it? Somebody must have noticed.
No, Bill and Kristen, to be honest, we got away with murder, literally.
Literally.
The CSI occupied a place that no television show had had in ages. In fact, really had never had it before because American television was even more global than it had been when shows like Gunsmoke and ER were pulled to airwaves. Right. So I want to say it aired in 196 countries, something like that, and there are only 198 to begin with. I mean, it was like almost every country, whether it was bootlegged or legitimate, had CSI.
A question.
So because of that reach, they'd let us do pretty much whatever we wanted to do.
Well, to that end, was there ever an episode that was run and then not repeated because of feedback that you got from fans or, you know, anything like that?
You know, it occurs to me that there was, and I don't remember which one it was. It wasn't during my time there. I will tell you that in the Tarantino episode we were talking about, there's a scene toward the end where Nick Stokes imagines his own autopsy after his death.
Oh, yeah, I hated that scene.
Wow.
Yeah, well, it was pretty strong. And frankly, I think that's when we added, when we realized we needed to fill a little time.
Right.
And it was a crazy fantasy scene. We had to print it in black and white because it was just too much in color. It was just too graphic.
Wow.
Quentin really went all Tarantino.
He went, yeah.
We had to pull it back. We objected, but I think it now, with hindsight, that's the right call.
So did the scene stay in?
Yeah, but it's in black and white. we just because it's a dream, so we can we could do that.
You could play around with it.
That's we did have an episode that I don't think got rerun a lot called, forget the title, but it was about a guy, a grown man, late middle-aged man, was a little portly, who had a fetish of infantilization, a sexual fetish. He wanted to be
King Baby.
King Baby, thank you. We actually got in trouble with the Justice Department for that one.
Why? I mean, I thought it was more like from a taste and style perspective.
I would have thought that too. Wow.
No, it was right after the Super Bowl where Janet Jackson had a wardrobe malfunction.
Oh, yeah.
And suddenly decency is, my dog is contributing. It's not his favorite episode either. there was a very big push from some of the conservative parents, Television Council and some others.
Right.
Start looking at all the programming. And they thought CSI was pushing the envelope anyway. I mean, we're on late at night still. And we had there was a poopy diaper was part of the evidence. And they really objected to seeing that. So.
Yeah.
I think that episode didn't rerun until that was altered in the master print or whatever they did.
We should give credit. What's your dog's name again, please?
That is Leonard.
Leonard. We just want to make certain, we're all about credit. We're credit's due. Leonard appeared in this episode of Mind Over Murder.
I'm so proud of the boy.
Leonard as the barking dog.
Yes.
Was there ever a particular episode that touched members of the cast or crew in a particular way, in your opinion?
Well, on a personal level, the farewells were always hard. When an actor was going to leave the series, that was very, very hard. I remember when the character of Warwick was killed.
This
is another Billy Peterson monologue story. We had to do the funeral, and I don't think Alan MacDonald, who wrote the episode, will mind me telling the story, because he came to me and he said, I've never written a eulogy and Grissom has to say something.
That's right.
For Warwick. Could I help him? And I drafted something, and Alan thought it was beautiful. I don't think he changed a word. In fact, I think it went into the final script pretty intact. But of course, Billy took one look at it and said, I'm not saying all this. I'll just say, I'll start to talk and then I'll get emotional and I'll just say, I miss him so much. It'll be simple and brief.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. And of course, on the day, action, Billy does the whole thing, word perfect, and we're all sobbing.
There
was that.
But it is sad, though. In other words, even though Gary Dudon was the actor, even though he was still alive and well, you are saying goodbye to someone that you've worked with for a number of years. So there is an element of sadness. And so it sounds like Peterson was able to kind of tap into some of the sadness of,
he did,
losing a longtime colleague.
Yeah, no, that was a hard one. And when Georgia Fox left the show, that episode was really hard, but she came back. So, we didn't know that would be the case at the time, but so actors leave for different reasons than they come back. But I know I wrote an episode called Still Life, which is my favorite episode of my seven
it's
seasons.
It's amazing.
Isn't it good, Chris?
It's love that amazing. One. Yeah. And
I know Marg had a couple of scenes with Billy in particular, but Marg really related to that one personally. All the scenes with the parents and the kid. It was about a missing child.
Right. And she's a mom and the whole thing.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. It was very personal. But that happens to CSIs in real life, too.
Oh, of the ones that we've met, absolutely. And they do get very wrapped up. I would say that almost everyone that we've met, which is a lot of folks now, who've either worked on my sister's case or other unsolved murder cases or what have you, people that we've met through Crime Con, which is, by the way, if you've not been yet, I assume.
No.
It's actually awesome. Amazing. We've been twice now, and it is incredible. They would love to put something together around you guys, I'm sure.
Oh my God. Yes.
We love it.
It's thousands of people who are extremely enthusiastic about true crime, and they're interested in, both fictional and nonfiction presentations of crime in all its facets. It's really, really fun. I'm sure they would go bonkers if you guys ever wanted to put something together.
We should look into that, because I think it'd be fun for us. And we have a little hindsight now. We've sort of seen the children of CSI as more crime shows have come on the air and how they've changed because of our show. and what viewers want. I mean, it really is all about the viewers.
Speaking of departures.
And that does actually kind of go to what I was going to ask, which is, what do you consider, I know this is probably going to be a multifaceted answer, what do you consider CSI's legacy to be? Of course, there's going to be more than one.
Well, I think there are two legacies. I think there's the effect the show had on television, genre television, telling crime stories from a new perspective, a scientific perspective, as well as character and plot. I think that had a lot to do with it. I think the larger legacy is the impact it had on the field itself, on people entering the field and wanting to enter the field, and people being able, particularly women, being able to see themselves as criminals. I was on vacation in Peru about 4 years ago over at the Christmas holidays, and, you know, went to Machu Picchu and all of the great things, and had a guide the whole time, a wonderful man who'd grown up in the Sacred Valley. He had two daughters. And I don't talk about my work when I travel. I really don't, because the show is so big. My vacation ends and talk about CSI starts, and I don't have a vacation because the show is so global. The impact is so deep. But he asked, and somehow it came out and mentioned CSI, and he was floored because his daughter, who at the time was 15 or 16, was starting to think about what to study at university, and she loved CSI. She loved the character of Sarah Seidel, and she wanted to study forensic pathology. She wanted to become a pathologist because of our show. A girl in Peru.
That is so cool. You hadn't brought it up, but then it did come up, and he immediately made the connection with his daughter's interest in the field.
And she started, it was funny, we walked out of the cathedral on our last day with her father, and he said, "Oh, I'm so sorry. I'm so embarrassed. We told her not to come." She was waiting for us.
Of course she was.
She was the most sweetest girl, the most beautiful girl you cannot imagine. She was so smart and so kind, and we spoke pretty good English too, as I recall, and we just had the greatest conversation. And she's in university now. I'm sure she's in the equivalent, you know, whatever medical school she's attending down there, and I'm very proud of her.
Very cool. Look at you. You're like an inspiration.
The show. Team effort. Every episode, start to finish.
And I do understand why you're on vacation, you're on holiday, you want to have a good time, and you don't necessarily want to talk shop while you're trying to enjoy your Christmas vacation.
Yeah, that guide, it was such a great fellow, and he said, just a few months ago, I was the guide for Leonardo DiCaprio and his friends.
Well, I'm impressed.
And I said, I'm lucky them, because you're terrific, but I just want to assure you, even though we're in a similar business, the tip may not be quite as great at the end. He's in a different league.
Yeah, he's there's the Leo budget, and then there's everybody else.
Yeah.
When you were talking about departures, why did Billy Peterson decide to leave the show? He'd been on the show for what, 10 years?
No, he did eight and a half seasons. He left in the middle of season 9.
Right.
And we were doing 24, sometimes 25 episodes a season. Grissom carried all the weight, and it was taking a toll on Billy, I'm sure. He cared so much about the show, and he worked very, very hard on the show. In a way, he really created it. I cannot believe it would have taken off as it did with anyone else in that role. But you get to a point where, especially for a theater actor, you want to go on to the next thing. And he had just married. He had a lovely wife. They had just had children and a couple of twin boys, and that was a little touch and go for them at one point with the kids. They're fine now, but it would be, they were born prematurely. It was, there was a lot on his mind, and I can see why. He just felt it was time. He had given the show. And by the way, Billy's the guy who always said, by the time he got to episode 21 or 22, no matter what season, this is it. I can't do this again. I'm not going to do this again. And then, of course,
and that wasn't written in a monologue.
I think he just felt it was time. He'd done. Gosh, I think at that point it was over 200 episodes, maybe 250 at that point.
So. And there was a lot built around the character, and so resulting pressure on him, a lot of weight, I would imagine, on his shoulders.
Yeah, exactly. And you can't replace him, but who do you get to bring in to pick up the torch and run? And we experiment. We had Liev Schreiber came in for four terrific episodes.
He was great.
That was one of the greatest experiences of my life. He can write better than our writers, act better than our actors, direct better than our directors. He is an amazing talent.
Yeah.
And he was so gracious and so, I love working with him.
Had he agreed, though, to sign on for the long haul? I mean, there's a guy who's done a lot of different things as well.
Oh, yeah. I think he wanted to flex his television muscles. He had done some television, but nothing, you know, where he's carrying this episode or whatever. And he did four. That was the deal. He would do four. And we the one thing we felt we had to do was kill off his character. That we had to make sure that Grissom was coming back and running the show. And finally, we did one episode where Liev and Billy's characters passed in the crime lab. They rehearsed their scene before we shot it. And after rehearsal, Billy came over to me and said, "He's fantastic. Why are we killing him off?" That was kind of the deal. But it was interesting to see. It was sort of dipping our toe in the water of could someone else run the crime lab.
Mind Over Murder is a production of Absolute Zero and Another Dog Productions.
Our executive producers are Bill Thomas and Kristen Dilley.
Our logo art is by Pamela Arnois.
Our theme music is by Kevin MacLeod.
Mind Over Murder is distributed in partnership with Crawl Space Media.
You can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram.
You can also follow our page on the Colonial Parkway Murders on Facebook.
And finally, you can follow Bill Thomas on Twitter at BillThomas56.
Thank you for listening to Mind Over Murder.